This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And we need to work with different members of the community. We need to ensure that the understanding around this being a human rights violation, a form of gender-based violence, and accountability to ensure that those who have obligations to protect the rights of women and girls to be free from this.
That is Sunita Kamina, UN Women Regional Policy Specialist on Ending Violence Against Women for East and Southern Africa. On this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence campaign. Details coming up. Also, the Israeli-Hamas truce is extended a second time, and the COP28 Climate Change Conference is getting underway. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Israel and Hamas early today agreed to extend by one more day a truce under which hostages are exchanged for Palestinian prisoners and aid flows into the war-devastated Gaza Strip. Militants took about 240 captives from southern Israel during the October 7th attack that Israel officials say killed around 1,200 people, most of them civilians. In response, Israel has vowed to eliminate Hamas, an Islamist movement with an armed wing. Its air, artillery, and naval bombardment alongside a ground offensive have killed nearly 15,000 people, according to Gaza's Hamas rulers. Since the ceasefire began last week, Hamas has freed more than 80 hostages, both Israel citizens and foreign nationals. Israel has released about 180 Palestinian prisoners from its jails. Also today, Hamas claimed responsibility for a shooting in Jerusalem that killed three people shortly after the truce extension. Police said the two gunmen from Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem opened fire on people near a bus stop on the western side of Jerusalem. The attackers were shot dead by two off-duty soldiers and a civilian police. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Israel today, his third trip to the region since the conflict began. VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain is on the line with me now to talk about Blinken's trip. Welcome to African News Tonight, Cindy.
Thank you so much, Yehia.
So, Cindy, what is the purpose of this trip?
Well, the main purposes of the trip, as you said, are starting with the Secretary Blinken wants to prolong the pause in fighting. He said that this is productive, saying that hostages are being released, they're being reunited with their families, and also desperately needed humanitarian aid is flowing into Gaza for Palestinian civilians. So that is one main objective, is prolonging these pauses. Another, though, is that when the truce does end, and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has made clear that that the war is not over, the U.S. is being very deliberate in saying that what behind the scenes, at least, what happened in northern Gaza should not be repeated in southern Gaza, and that there needs to be more and better protections for civilians, many of whom Israel asked to flee from the north to the south, so that the kind of weapons and the kind of operations that were deployed in the north should not happen in the south.
There are growing international calls for a longer ceasefire and rising anger over civilian casualties in Gaza. Is there a sense that U.S. support and its message to Israel is evolving?
Yes, exactly. And I just touched that on a little bit with concern and that being relayed very strongly, also in a phone call from President Biden to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu about operations in the south. But also with concerns being relayed about Israeli settlers attacking Palestinians in the West Bank. So I think that tone is changing. And there was one tweet by President Biden recently where he said that Hamas just wants to sow like a never-ending cycle of violence between Israeli and Palestinians, and he said that is not in our interest. But basically, a bit of a change there, saying military solutions are not the answer.
Secretary Blinken meet with Mohammed Abusa in the West Bank?
Yes, he did meet with him, and Abbas raised the topic of the forced deployment of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, and basically pressed for, as you said, for a longer ceasefire, and emphasized the unity of Palestinians, saying that in the West Bank, Palestinians would not abandon Palestinians in Gaza.
And finally, Cindy, after this trip, Secretary Blinken heads to the COP28 Climate Summit in Dubai. What message will he be taking to Dubai?
Right. Well, there was some disappointment that at this largest ever climate gathering, President Biden was not planning to attend himself, and the Chinese President Xi is also not attending, arguably two of the most important leaders for this critical issue of climate change. But we've gotten word that Vice President Kamala Harris will also attend on behalf of President Biden on December 1st and 2nd. And we have Secretary Blinken and the U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry. So it will be a big presence there. And the U.S. has said it will work with China to make sure that these U.N. Climate negotiations are a success.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
As global leaders meet in Dubai to discuss climate change, a top issue is how the world is failing to limit carbon dioxide emissions. COP28 will also highlight success stories, mostly large-scale investments, but there are also small-scale innovations driven by communities that offer significant promise if scaled up, like solar power. Farmers are looking for low or no-cost materials to increase agricultural output and reduce the use of fertilizers derived from fossil fuels. One such material used in Kenya is biochar, which increases water and nutrient retention and helps hold carbon. Chris Mokolu, East African Regional Director of the NGO World Neighbors, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam his group teaches farmers how to make and use biochar.
It is made from agricultural residue, particularly maize cobs and maize stalk. Once the farmers have harvested, they collect the maize stalks, and once they have shelled the crop, they remain with the maize cob. So maize cobs and maize stalks can be used to produce biochar through a slow burning process known as pyrolysis, and the product, it is used as manure during the planting of cereals as well as other crops like vegetables, beans, or even fruit trees.
This biochar is used like fertilizer.
Yes, it is fertilizer. Very, very low cost in the sense that farmers make it themselves. It reduces their cost of input. And biochar itself revitalizes the soil. It is good for improving soil health, soil quality, which is very, very important, because industrial agriculture, where farmers have been using chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides and fungicides, have been killing the soil, destroying microorganisms that are in the soil. And therefore, when farmers plant their crops, they don't get good yields. So industrial agriculture has really messed up much of the soil that the farmers use. So
you're saying that this is good not only because it's good for the soil and regenerating like the soil, but they don't have to buy these chemicals and buy additional ingredients or whatever materials to put down on their fields.
Exactly. It serves a number of purposes. Just like you have said, it rejuvenates the soil, reduces the acidity of the soil, because it is kind of alkaline in nature, and It reduces the cost of input, so the farmers spend less when they use biochar as one of the fertilizers that they use for planting cereals and other crops.
And how does your organization come into this? Do you teach farmers how to do it, or do you make the stuff yourself and distribute it to farmers, or how does it work?
No, we train the farmers how to make it because it is very easy to make. There are two ways about it. One is that you use a vertical drum, metal drum, with some holes drilled in its trunk, and then you put the cobs inside and light the fire, and you keep on pouring water from outside until the cobs burn, and then you get them out, and then you have biochar. The other method is that you dig a trench on the ground, and this one is mainly for stock, maize stock and sorghum stock. Then you lay them in there and cover with some metal sheet, and then they burn, and then you get them out. So we trained them. Mm-hmm. Now they use them themselves. Some of them even sell. They can make quite a number of big quantities and sell to other farmers who may not have been able to make them or who need extra biochar.
That's Chris Makolu, East Africa Regional Director for the NGO World Neighbors. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. As we cover the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence campaign in part two of my conversation with Sunita Kamina, UN Women Regional Policy Specialist on Ending Violence Against Women for East and Southern Africa, she points out that gender-based violence takes many forms: physical, sexual, emotional, and psychological. She discusses sex trafficking, intimate partner violence, as well as non-partner sexual violence, as well as female genital mutilation, or FGM.
So FGM, as a manifestation, you know, is one form of gender-based violence. At the base of this is that control over women's bodies, over their bodily autonomy to make decisions about their bodies, to control their sexuality. And so, yes, it is a practice in the region of Africa, but also in other regions. And what we see is that, well, there are some positive trends in reduction. We can also see some concerning trends in how it's being practiced, and have it, you know, so that while there are laws in place in some contexts, and that's a really important foundation, while there are policies and action plans and some resourcing being allocated to the issue, it's not enough to actually stop the practice from happening in the first place, because we have to really ensure that the social norms that enable it to happen in the first place are addressed. And this is where, again, we need to work with different members of the community. We need to ensure that the understanding around this being a human rights violation, a form of gender-based violence, and accountability to ensure that those who have obligations to protect the rights of women and girls to be free from this form of violence is upheld and put in place.
And Sunita, while I was preparing for this interview, I was researching and I found that two of the most prevalent types of violence that women experience are intimate partner violence, IPV, and the non-partner sexual violence, NPSV. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. So intimate partner violence is, as you mentioned, the most prevalent form of violence. This is part violence that can take the shape of physical abuse, sexual violence, emotional, financial, psychological. So it's really important to recognize that this violence is very common, and it's not always recognized in a physical form, because I think often we hear about stories of intimate partner violence, perhaps in the more physical or sexual forms, but we don't really talk about the controlling behaviors and emotional abuse, the financial and economic abuse that is also part of it. And also recognizing that intimate partner violence can take place both in online and offline, right? So in physical spaces, but also in the online space. And so often there is a connection between different experiences of violence. In terms of non-partner sexual violence, again, this is also something that is very common, underreported because of a lot of barriers that individuals face in terms of the stigma, victim blaming, the financial cost, bias by service providers that might make someone feel, you know, ashamed to report, pressure from families or community members not to disclose abuse, especially if it's someone with a particular, from someone with a particular profile. So there's a lot of barriers to reporting these different forms of violence. The consequences of these violence go to beyond, you know, to fall not only on the individual who experiences them, but also have significant consequences to those around them, whether they're children in the case of a individual who's a parent, in the context of their employment, their education, and in turn affects the entire communities and has high costs for countries as a whole.
And another evil of gender-based violence is sex trafficking.
Yes, and so all of these forms connect to, again, gender inequality and discrimination against women. So when we're thinking about issues of trafficking and the different experiences of trafficking that women experience from men, and sex trafficking is one of them, the gender dynamics that put women in situations of vulnerability and at risk, the social norms that look at controlling women's sexuality and put blame on victims from their experiences with sexual violence, all contribute then to experiences with sexual trafficking. So there is also a connection between individuals who are at risk or have experienced one form of violence with their experiences with another. And it's really important to recognize that there are these web of experiences that then have to be addressed in a holistic way.
That was Sunita Kamina, UN Women Regional Policy Specialist on Ending Violence Against Women for East and Southern Africa. She talked to me from Nairobi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Ethiopia's central bank chief says the country has secured a $1.5 billion debt relief agreement with creditors, temporarily easing its financial burden as it seeks a wider funding program. The accord was announced by National Bank of Ethiopia Governor Mamum Heretu and confirmed in a statement from the Paris Club of Creditors Nations, which describes it as an important achievement. According to the French news agency AFP, Mamo told the parliamentary committee that the debt service suspension will help save around 1.5 billion to debt servicing. Ethiopia's finances have been hit by the two-year conflict in the northern region of Tigray that ended with a peace deal a year ago. Addis Ababa says it needs around $20 billion to rebuild northern Ethiopia after the war that claimed the lives of around 500,000 people. Ethiopia has about $28 billion of external debt and is also grappling with sky-high inflation and a shortage of foreign currency reserves. The U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee Subcommittee on Africa is holding a hearing today on the topic, Ethiopia Promise or Pearls of the U.S. Policy. Two career diplomats are testifying, fighting between Ethiopian national troops and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front has ended following a brutal two-year war that killed thousands of civilians. However, many experts say atrocities continue in the East African country. VOA's Carol Van Dam is covering the hearing and files from Capitol Hill.
The chairman, Representative John James, talked about the need for a stable Ethiopia, being it's good for the Horn of Africa, it's also good for the rest of the world. But he added that he's very concerned about the current status of the cessation of hostilities agreement, which was signed just a little over a year ago. And even though he pointed out that there's been a decrease in fighting, there's also all kinds of atrocities that are still being committed, especially in the Amhara region and Oromia. He said that the greater conflict is clouded in Ethiopia's future, especially in Tigray and Amhara. Then we heard from Mike Hammer, who is the special envoy to the Horn of Africa for the U.S. government, and he conceded that there are still problems, but he said that the experts that have been there have agreed that it's the deadliest conflict in the 21st century so far. And that there are still problems, but that, you know, they are hoping that this continuing dialogue with government officials will lead to more peace and stability in the region. He also mentioned that he had just returned last week from Addis, where he spoke with several high-level government officials about the need for accountability in these future transitional courts that were going to be held by the local government to make sure that accountability is met.
Around the world, people are marking the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Help us mark the work to end violence against women by sharing your thoughts on VOA's English to Africa radio programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076, before December 10th. Tell us what is being done in your community to fight gender-based violence and tell us why this issue is important to you. That number again is +1 202 258 3076.
In the bustling local markets of Mogadishu, Somalia, local business owners say imported Chinese products are rapidly displacing their own manufactured goods. Abdul Qadir Zubair spoke to several business owners in Mogadishu and has this report narrated by Carol Van Dam.
4 years ago, Abukar Sheikh Abu's shop used to be full, producing at least 20 pairs of shoes daily. But nowadays, he says, the market has changed, with Chinese-made products challenging local businessmen like him.
These shoes had a market before Chinese-made products flooded the country, costing $2 to $3. We make high-quality shoes. They are soft and comfortable, especially for people suffering from burning feet, sign of nerve damage. Our market used to thrive, and we used to ship our products to Hargeisa, Djibouti, and South Africa. However, nowadays, Chinese-made products pose a challenge.
While Abu now produces only a few pairs daily, his main distribution is from customer orders of clients who appreciate his products, like Sufi Mohammed Amin.
I prefer these pairs of shoes because they are made of leather and provide comfort, unlike Chinese-made shoes.
China does not only import shoes into Somalia, it also offers other products, from clothing to utensils. Some customers like Ahmed Mohammed Hassan say they prefer products from countries other than China.
These clothes are not made in China. They are of high quality, and I frequently purchase clothes from this store during every festival. They import the clothes from the U.S., and they cost around $30, in contrast to Chinese-made products, which cost $4 to $5.
Fartoon Kasim Ali purchases utensils from a local market in Mogadishu.
We come here to buy utensils for gatherings. Locally made utensils have limited variety, but those from abroad offer a wide selection, from jugs to plates.
Buying imported goods poses a challenge to locally made products, business owners say. Saeed Ali Maulid, a shopkeeper in the city, says it's disheartening to see people choose imported goods over local products.
Many people prefer imported goods over locally made products. And that is discouraging if you ask the person why they prefer imported goods. They might respond in a demeaning manner, saying this is a Somali-made thing.
Meanwhile, in the capital, small business owners like Abu say Chinese imports also affect the employment of skilled young people who used to craft local shoes.
We used to create employment opportunities by making these shoes. For instance, sewing cost $1, and the craftsmanship and other labor for a pair of two shoes cost $10. We used to sell each pair for $25 to $30.
Somali business owners say they find themselves in a precarious situation due to Chinese imports pushing them or their products out of markets. For Abdul Qadir Zubair in Mogadishu, Somalia, I'm Carol Van Dam.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.